Conspiracy Theories, Preliminary Draft January 15, 2008, and Kasar Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule. Group Polarization. There are clear links between cascades and the well-established phenomenon of group polarization, by which members of a deliberating group typically end up in a more extreme position in line with their tendencies before deliberation began. Group polarization has been found in hundreds of studies involving over a dozen countries. Belief in conspiracy theories is often fueled by group polarization. Consider, as the clearest example, the finding that those who disapprove of the United States and are suspicious of its intentions will increase their disapproval and suspicion if they exchange points of view. There is specific evidence of this phenomenon among citizens of France with respect to foreign aid. They trust the United States a great deal less and suspect its intentions a great deal more after they talk with one another. It should be easy to see how similar effects could occur for conspiracy theories. Those who tend to think that Israel was responsible for the attacks of 9/11 and who speak with one another will end up with a greater commitment to that belief. Group polarization occurs for reasons that parallel the mechanisms that produce cascades. Informational influences play a large role. In any group with some initial inclination, the views of most people in the group will inevitably be skewed in the direction of that inclination. As a result of hearing the various arguments, social interactions will lead people toward a more extreme point in line with what group members initially believe. Reputational factors matter as well. People usually want to be perceived favorably by other group members. Once they hear what others believe, some will adjust their positions at least slightly in the direction of the dominant position. For purposes of understanding the spread of conspiracy theories, it is especially important to note that group polarization is particularly likely and particularly pronounced when people have a shared sense of identity and are connected by bonds of solidarity. These are circumstances in which arguments by outsiders, unconnected with the group, will lack much credibility and fail to have much of an effect in reducing polarization. As we will explore below, these circumstances imply that direct government rebuttals of the reigning conspiracy theory will prove ineffective. Government will instead do best by using various tactics of cognitive infiltration to break up the polarized information cluster from within. Selection effects. A crippled epistemology can arise not only from informational and reputational dynamics within a given group, but also from self-selection of members into and out of groups with extreme views. Once polarization occurs, or cascades arise, and the group's median view begins to move in a certain direction, doubters and halfway believers will tend to depart while intense believers remain. The overall size of the group may shrink, but the group may also pick up new believers who are even more committed, and in any event the remaining members will, by self-selection, display more fanaticism. Group members may engage in a kind of double-think, segregating themselves in a physical or informational sense in order to protect their beliefs from challenge by outsiders. Even if the rank and file cannot coherently do this, group leaders may enforce segregation in order to insulate the rank and file from information or arguments that would undermine the leader's hold on the group. Members of informationally and socially isolated groups tend to display a kind of paranoid cognition and become increasingly distrustful or suspicious of the motives of others or of the larger society, falling into a sinister attribution error. This error occurs when people feel that they are under pervasive scrutiny, and hence they attribute personalistic motives to outsiders and overestimate the amount of attention they receive. Benign actions that happen to disadvantage the group are taken as purposeful plots intended to harm. Although these conditions resemble individual-level pathologies, they arise from the social and informational structure of the group, especially those operating in enclosed or closely knit networks, and are not usefully understood as a form of mental illness. The social etiology of such conditions suggests that the appropriate remedy is not individual treatment, but the introduction of cognitive, informational, and social diversity into the isolated networks that supply extremist theories. We take up the resulting policy problems in the next part. 2. Governmental responses. What can government do about conspiracy theories? Among the things it can do, what should it do? We can readily imagine a series of possible responses. 1. Government might ban conspiracy theorizing. 2. Government might impose some kind of tax, financial or otherwise, on those who disseminate such theories. 3. Government might itself engage in counter-speech, marshalling arguments, to discredit conspiracy theories. 4. Government might formally hire credible private parties to engage in counter-speech. 5. Government might engage in informal communication with such parties, encouraging them to help. Each instrument has a distinctive set of potential effects, or costs and benefits, and each will have a place, under imaginable conditions. However, our main policy idea is that government should engage in cognitive infiltration of the groups that produce conspiracy theories, which involves a mix of 3, 4, and 5. If one believes that conspiracy theories are in some sense inconsequential, the best answer will be for government to ignore them. If children believe in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, there is no problem for government to solve, and the belief that the government covered up the landing of space aliens in Roswell does not seem to be causing discernible harm, with the possible exception of bad television shows. This does not imply that government should ignore conspiracy theories only if they are inconsequential. As we will see, under certain conditions government may do best to ignore conspiracy theories and theorists even if it justifiably fears that they will have harmful effects, because government action may make things worse. In Section A, however, we give some reasons to think that some conspiracy theories are consequential indeed. In Section B, we address several dilemmas of governmental response to conspiracy theories and theorists. Is it best to ignore them, creating a risk that the theory will spread unrebutted, or to address them, with the risk that addressing the theory will legitimate, and even be taken to confirm it? Assuming budget constraints and limited resources, should government efforts focus on debiasing the conspiracy theorists themselves, or solely on preventing the spread of conspiracy theories among the larger population? How can government get behind or around the distinctive feature of conspiracy theories, their self-sealing quality, which tends to fold government's denials into the theory itself as further evidence of the conspiracy? An obvious answer is to maintain an open society in which those who are tempted to subscribe to conspiracy theories do not distrust all knowledge-creating institutions and are exposed to corrections. But we have seen that even in open societies, conspiracy theories have some traction, and open societies have a strong interest in debunking such theories when they arise and threaten to cause harm in closed societies. Here we suggest two concrete ideas for government officials attempting to fashion a response to such theories. First, responding to more rather than fewer conspiracy theories has a kind of synergy benefit. It reduces the legitimating effect of responding to any one of them because it dilutes the contrast with unrebutted theories. Second, we suggest a distinctive tactic for breaking up the hardcore of extremists who supply conspiracy theories, cognitive infiltration of extremist groups, whereby government agents or their allies, acting either virtually or in real space, and either openly or anonymously, will undermine the crippled epistemology of those who subscribe to such theories. They do so by planting doubts about the theories and stylized facts that circulate within such groups, thereby introducing beneficial cognitive diversity. In Section C, we examine the role of law and judges in fashioning the government's response. We will ask whether judges do more good than harm by invoking statutes such as the Freedom of Information Act to force government to disclose facts that would rebut conspiracy theories. Our conclusions are generally skeptical. There is little reason to believe that judges can improve on administrative choices in these situations. Section D concludes with some brief notes on government efforts to dispel conspiracy theories held by foreign audiences, especially in Muslim countries. Throughout, we assume a well-motivated government that aims to eliminate conspiracy theories or draw their poison if and only if social welfare is improved by doing so. We do not offer a particular account of social welfare, taking the term instead as a placeholder for the right account. This is a standard assumption in policy analysis and is useful for clarifying the policy questions, but we note that real-world governments can instead be purveyors of conspiracy theories. In Egypt, newspapers effectively controlled by the governing regime regularly spread conspiracy theories about Jews. Some believe that the Bush administration deliberately spread a kind of false and unwarranted conspiracy theory that Saddam Hussein conspired with Al-Qaeda to support the 9/11 attacks. Suppose for discussion's sake that this is so, then a future administration motivated to improve social welfare would need to consider whether this theory is false and harmful, and if it is, what can and should be done about it. but this would just be another case of a conspiracy theory circulating in the population, which might or might not be worth responding to, in light of the considerations we adduce below. Nothing of theoretical interest follows from this case for the questions we address here, which strictly involve optimal responses to conspiracy theories, on the part of a real or imagined, well-motivated government. Are conspiracy theories consequential? One line of thinking denies that conspiracy theories matter. There are several possible reasons to think. So first, conspiracy theories may be held by only a tiny fraction of the population. Perhaps only a handful of kooks believe that U.S. government officials had any kind of role in the events of 9/11. Second, even if a particular conspiracy theory is widely held in the sense that many people will confess to it, when polled, conspiracy theories may typically be held as quasi-beliefs, beliefs that are not costly, and possibly even fun to hold, like a belief in aliens and Roswell or UFOs, and that do not form a premise for action. Many people profess to believe, and in some sense to believe, that eternal life depends upon actions that they do not take. So too, perhaps many people quasi-believe in conspiracy theories yet do not take action on account of those quasi-beliefs. In both cases everything depends, of course, on which conspiracy theory and which population one is discussing. However, as discussed in Part I, there is ample evidence that some conspiracy theories are not at all confined to small segments of the population. Overseas, a 2002 Gallup poll conducted in 9 Islamic countries found that 61% of those surveyed thought that Muslims had nothing to do with the attacks of September 11, 2001. According to an anonymous State Department official in charge of anti-disinformation, a great deal of harm can result when people believe these lies, and then act on the basis of their mistaken beliefs. For example, Al-Qaeda members were encouraged to join the jihad at least in part because of disinformation. The point about quasi-beliefs suggests that many do not in fact take any action on the basis of their mistaken beliefs. However, this does not at all entail that conspiracy theories are inconsequential. Even if only a small fraction of adherents to a particular conspiracy theory act on the basis of their beliefs, that small fraction may be enough to cause serious harms. Consider the Oklahoma City bombing, whose perpetrators shared the complex of conspiratorial beliefs about the federal government. Many who shared their beliefs did not act on them, but a few actors did, with terrifying consequences. James Fearon and others argue that technological change has driven down the costs of delivering attacks with weapons of mass destruction to the point where even a small group can pose a significant threat. If so, and if only a tiny fraction of believers act on their beliefs, then, as the total population with conspiratorial beliefs grows, it becomes nearly inevitable that action will ensue. In cases of this sort, the conspiracy theory itself supports affirmatively violent action on the part of its believers, which only a small fraction will actually take. Conspiracy theorizing leads to an actual conspiracy within a network whose members believe that the federal government, say, is a hostile and morally repellent organization that is taking over the country, akin to a foreign invader. Armed resistance will seem a sensible course to at least some fraction of the believers. In other, perhaps more common cases, the conspiracy theory will be of a different nature and will not directly indicate such action. However, such theories can still have pernicious effects from the government's point of view, either by inducing unjustifiably widespread public skepticism about the government's assertions, or by dampening public mobilization and participation in government-led efforts, or both. The widespread belief that U.S. officials knowingly allowed 9/11 to happen or even brought it about may have hampered the government's efforts to mobilize social resources and political support for measures against future terrorist attacks. In the nature of things, it is hard to find evidence for or against such possibilities, yet it hardly seems sensible to say that because such evidence is lacking, government should do nothing about a potentially harmful conspiracy theory. That precept would be paralyzing, because there are uncertain harms on all sides of the question, and because, as in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing, some of those harms may approach the catastrophic. Be dilemmas and responses. Imagine a government facing a population in which a particular conspiracy theory is becoming widespread. We will identify two basic dilemmas that recur, and consider how government should respond. The first dilemma is whether to ignore or rebut the theory. The second is whether to address the supply side of conspiracy theorizing by attempting to debias or disable its purveyors, to address the demand side by attempting to immunize third-party audiences from the theory's effects, or to do both if resource constraints permit. In both cases, the underlying structure of the problem is that conspiracy theorizing is a multi-party game. Government is faced with suppliers of conspiracy theories and might aim at least in part to persuade, debias, or silence those suppliers. However, those two players are competing for the hearts and minds of third parties, especially the mass audience of the uncommitted, expanding the cast further. One may see the game as involving four players: government officials, conspiracy theorists, mass audiences, and independent experts such as mainstream scientists or the editors of Popular Mechanics, whom government attempts to enlist to give credibility to its rebuttal efforts. The discussion that follows generally assumes the three-party structure, but we will refer to the four-party structure when relevant. 1. Ignore or rebut. The first dilemma is that either ignoring or rebutting a conspiracy theory has distinctive costs. Ignoring the theory allows its proponents to draw ominous inferences from the government's silence. If a theory stands unrebutted, one possibility is that it is too ludicrous to need rebuttal, but another is that the government cannot offer relevant evidence to the contrary. The suppliers of the conspiracy theories will propose the second inference. On this view, all misinformation, the initial conspiracy theory, should be met with counter-misinformation. On the other hand, to rebut the theory may be to legitimate it, moving the theory from the zone of claims too ludicrous to be discussed to the zone of claims that, whether or not true, are in some sense worth discussing. This legitimation effect can arise in one of two ways. First, third-party audiences may infer from the government's rebuttal efforts that the government estimates the conspiracy theory to be plausible, and fears that the third parties will themselves be persuaded. Second, some members of the audience may infer that many other members of the audience must believe the theory, or government would not be taking the trouble to rebut it. Consider circumstances of pluralistic ignorance, in which citizens are unsure what other citizens believe. Citizens may take the fact of rebuttal itself as supplying information about the beliefs of other citizens, and may even use this information in forming their own beliefs. The government's rebuttal may be a signal that other citizens believe in the conspiracy theory, and may therefore make the theory more plausible. If the number who follow this cognitive strategy, and thus adopt a belief in the theory, exceeds the number who are persuaded by the rebuttal, the perverse result of the rebuttal may then be to increase the number of believers. How should government cope with this dilemma? In a typical pattern, government plays a wait-and-see strategy. Ignore the conspiracy theory until it reaches some ill-defined threshold level of widespread popularity, and then rebut. There is a straightforward logic to this strategy. First, when the government ignores the theory, either the relevant audiences will draw an inference that the theory is silly, or else will infer that the government cannot effectively deny it. If the conspiracy theory does not spread despite government's silence, the former inference is probably dominant, and response is unnecessary. Second, there is an option value to the strategy of ignoring the theory. A public rebuttal now is costly or impossible to undo, but maintaining silence now leaves government with the option to rebut later, if it chooses to do so. On this approach, when faced with a spreading conspiracy theory, government should wait until the marginal expected benefits of further delay just equal the marginal expected costs of leaving the theory unrebutted. Finally, and most generally, it seems silly and infeasible to chase after and rebut every conspiracy theory that comes to government's attention. However, this logic overlooks an important synergistic gain. Rebutting many conspiracy theories can reduce the legitimating effect of rebutting any one of them. When government rebuts a particular theory, while ignoring most others, the legitimating effect arises at least in part because of a contrast between the foreground and the background. The inference is that government has picked the theory it is rebutting out of the larger set because this theory, unlike the others, is inherently plausible, or is gaining traction among some sectors of the mass audience. Rebutting a larger fraction of the total background set reduces the strength of this inference as to each theory chosen for rebuttal. The more theories government rebuts, the weaker is the implicit legitimating signal sent by the very fact of rebuttal. It is impossible to say, in the abstract, how great the synergistic gain may be. It remains true that not every conspiracy theory proposed by someone somewhere that comes to the attention of relevant government officials warrants a response. However, The implication is that government should rebut more conspiracy theories, and it would otherwise choose, if assessing the expected costs and benefits of rebuttal on a theory-by-theory basis, because of synergy effects, government action considered over an array or range of cases may have different total costs and benefits than when those cases are considered one by one. Practically speaking, government might do well to maintain a more vigorous counter-misinformation establishment, and it would otherwise do. 1. That identifies and rebuts many more conspiracy theories would otherwise be rebutted. There will still have to be some minimum threshold for governmental response, but the threshold will be lower than it would be if the synergistic gain of rebutting many theories did not exist. 2. Which audience? Another dilemma is whether to target the supply side of the conspiracy theory or the demand side. Should governmental responses be addressed to the suppliers with a view to persuading or silencing them, or rather be addressed to the mass audience with a view to inoculating them from pernicious theories? Of course, these two strategies are not mutually exclusive. As a logical matter, perhaps the best approach is to straddle the two audiences with a single response, or simply to provide multiple responses. However, if there are resource constraints, government may face a choice about where to place its emphases. The question will be what mix of second-party responses, pitched to the suppliers, and third-party responses, pitched to the mass audience, is best. Moreover, apart from resource constraints, there are intrinsic trade-offs across these strategies. The very arguments that are most convincing to the mass audience may be least convincing to the conspiracists, and vice versa. We will begin with some remarks about responses addressed to the supply side. The basic problem with pitching governmental responses to the suppliers of conspiracy theories is that those theories, by their nature, have a self-sealing quality. They are, 1, resistant and in extreme cases invulnerable to contrary evidence, and, 2, especially resistant to contrary evidence offered by the government, because the government rebuttal is folded into the conspiracy theory itself. If conspiracy theorists are responding to the informational signals given by those whom they trust, then the government's effort at rebuttal seems unlikely to be effective, and might serve to fortify rather than to undermine the original belief. A possible solution is for government to enlist private rebuttals. We return to this point shortly. The most direct response to a dangerous conspiracy theories is censorship. That response is unavailable in an open society because it is inconsistent with principles of freedom of expression. We could imagine circumstances in which a conspiracy theory became so pervasive and so dangerous that censorship would be thinkable. But in an open society, the need for censorship would be correspondingly reduced. In any case, censorship may well turn out to be self-defeating. The effort to censor the theory might well be taken as evidence that the theory is true, and censorship of speech is notoriously difficult. After 9/11, one complex of conspiracy theories involved American Airlines flight, which hijackers crashed into the Pentagon. Some theorists claimed that no plane had hit the Pentagon, even after the Department of Defense released video frames showing Flight 77 approaching the building, and a later explosion cloud. Theorists pointed out that the actual moment of impact was absent from the video, in order to keep alive their claim that the plane had never hit the building. In reality, the moment of impact was not captured, because the video had a low number of frames per second. Moreover, even those conspiracists who were persuaded that the Flight 77 conspiracy theories were wrong folded that view into a larger conspiracy theory. The problem with the theory that no plane hit the Pentagon, they said, is that the theory was too transparently false, disproved by multiple witnesses and much physical evidence. Thus, the theory must have been a straw man initially planted by the government in order to discredit other conspiracy theories and theorists by association. Government can partially circumvent these problems if it enlists non-governmental officials in the effort to rebut the theories. It might ensure that credible independent experts offer the rebuttal, rather than government officials themselves. There is a trade-off between credibility and control, however. The price of credibility is that government cannot be seen to control the independent experts. Although government can supply these independent experts with information, and perhaps prod them into action from behind the scenes, too close a connection will prove self-defeating if it is exposed, as witness the humiliating disclosures showing that apparently independent opinions on scientific and regulatory questions were in fact paid for by think tanks with ties to the Bush administration. Even apart from this trade-off, conspiracy theorists may still fold independent third-party rebuttals into their theory by making conspiratorial claims of connection between the third party and the government. When Popular Mechanics offered its rebuttal of 9/11 conspiracy theories, conspiracists claimed that one of the magazine's reporters, Ben Chertoff, was the cousin of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and was spreading disinformation at the latter's behest. Because of these difficulties, many officials dismiss direct responses to the suppliers of conspiracy theorists as an exercise in futility. Rather, they implicitly frame their responses to the third-party mass audience, hoping to stem the spread of conspiracy theories by dampening the demand rather than by reducing the supply. Philip Zalico, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, says that the hardcore conspiracy theorists are totally committed. They have to repudiate much of their life identity in order not to accept some of that stuff. That's not our worry. Our worry is when things become infectious. Then this stuff can be deeply corrosive to public understanding. You can get where the bacteria can sicken the larger body. Likewise, when the National Institute of Standards and Technology issued a fact sheet to disprove the theory that the World Trade Center was brought down by a controlled demolition, the spokesman stated that we realize this fact sheet won't convince those who hold to the alternative theories that our findings are sound. In fact, the fact sheet was never intended for them. It is for the masses who have seen or heard the alternative theory claims and want balance. The problem with this line of argument, however, is that it takes the existence of a hardcore as a given. This is premature. We will suggest below that if the hardcore arises for certain identifiable reasons, it can be broken up or at least muted by government action. Furthermore, there are intrinsic costs to the strategy of giving up on the hardcore and directing government efforts solely towards inoculating the mass audience. For one thing, the hardcore may itself provide the most serious threat. For another, a response geared to a mass audience, whether or not nominally pitched, as a response to the conspiracy theorists, will lead some to embrace rather than reject the conspiracy theory the government is trying to rebut. This is the legitimation dilemma again. To begin a program of inoculation is to signal that the disease is already widespread and threatening. Under pluralistic ignorance, the perverse result may actually be to spread the conspiracy theory further. 3. Cognitive infiltration. Rather than taking the continued existence of the hardcore as a constraint and addressing itself solely to the third-party mass audience, government might undertake legal tactics for breaking up the tight cognitive clusters of extremist theories, arguments, and rhetoric that are produced by the hardcore, and reinforce it in turn. One promising tactic is cognitive infiltration of extremist groups. By this we do not mean 1960s-style infiltration, with a view to surveillance and collecting information, possibly for use in future prosecutions. Rather, we mean that government efforts might succeed in weakening, or even breaking up the ideological and epistemological complexes that constitute these networks and groups. How might this tactic work? Recall that extremist networks and groups, including the groups that purvey conspiracy theories, typically suffer from a kind of crippled epistemology. Hearing only conspiratorial accounts of government behavior, their members become ever more prone to believe and generate such accounts. Informational and reputational cascades, group polarization, and selection effects suggest that the generation of ever more extreme views within these groups can be dampened or reversed by the introduction of cognitive diversity. We suggest a role for government efforts and agents in introducing such diversity. Government agents and their allies might enter chat rooms, online social networks, or even real space groups, and attempt to undermine percolating conspiracy theories by raising doubts about their factual premises, causal logic, or implications for political action. In one variant, government agents would openly proclaim, or at least make no effort to conceal, their institutional affiliations. A recent newspaper story recounts that Arabic-speaking Muslim officials from the State Department have participated in dialogues at radical Islamist chat rooms and websites in order to ventilate arguments not usually heard among the groups that cluster around those sites, with some success. 68. In another variant, government officials would participate anonymously, or even with false identities. Each approach has distinct costs and benefits. The second is riskier, but potentially brings higher returns. In the former case, where government officials participate openly as such hardcore members of the relevant networks, communities, and conspiracy-minded organizations may entirely discount what the officials say, right from the beginning. The risk with tactics of anonymous participation, conversely, is that if the tactic becomes known, any true member of the relevant groups who raises doubts may be suspected of government connections. Despite these difficulties, the two forms of cognitive infiltration offer different risk-reward mixes and are both potentially useful instruments. There is a similar trade-off along another dimension, whether the infiltration should occur in the real world through physical penetration of conspiracist groups by undercover agents or instead should occur strictly in cyberspace. The latter is safer, but potentially less productive. The former will sometimes be indispensable where the groups that purvey conspiracy theories, and perhaps themselves formulate conspiracies, formulate their views through real space informational networks rather than virtual networks. Infiltration of any kind poses well-known risks. Perhaps agents will be asked to perform criminal acts to prove their bona fides, or, less plausibly, will themselves become persuaded by the conspiratorial views they are supposed to be undermining. Perhaps agents will be unmasked and harmed by the infiltrated group. But the risks are generally greater for real-world infiltration, where the agent is exposed to more serious harms. All these risk-reward trade-offs deserve careful consideration. Particular tactics may or may not be cost-justified under particular circumstances. Our main suggestion is just that, whatever the tactical details, there would seem to be ample reason for government efforts to introduce some cognitive diversity into the groups that generate conspiracy theories. Social cascades are sometimes quite fragile, precisely because they are based on small slivers of information. Once corrective information is introduced, large numbers of people can be shifted to different views. If government is able to have credibility or to act through credible agents, it might well be successful in dislodging beliefs that are held only because no one contradicts them. Likewise, polarization tends to decrease when divergent views are voiced within the group. 69 Introducing a measure of cognitive diversity can break up the epistemological networks and clusters that supply conspiracy theories. See a role for law and cohorts. So far we have detailed some dilemmas facing government officials and have suggested some policy responses. What, if anything, is the role of law and cohorts in these matters? The principal point of contact between the legal system and the issues discussed here is the Freedom of Information Act, which creates a presumption of transparency for documents held by administrative agencies and executive institutions. Unless the government can show that the requested information falls within one of a designated list of exceptions, there is a legal right to disclosure, and the Supreme Court has created a broad concept of informational standing to permit interested groups and citizens to enforce that right. Freedom of Information Act becomes relevant when the government holds and declines to disclose information that might rebut a circulating conspiracy theory. An example involves the Freedom of Information Act disclosure of the Department of Defense video involving Flight 77's crash into the Pentagon on 9/11. A pro-transparency group, Judicial Watch, filed a Freedom of Information Act request to obtain the video, but the Defense Department declined, saying that the video was to be used in the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. Judicial Watch filed suit to force disclosure with the avowed objective of using the video to rebut the conspiracy theories surrounding flight. However, when the Moussaoui trial ended, the government released the video before the lawsuit could be decided. The details of the case only suggest the larger question that it poses: should cohorts and law force the executive to disclose information that a litigant claims would help to rebut conspiracy theories? If the answer is yes, then control over the timing and nature of the executive's responsive strategy will be partially transferred to litigating groups and judges. If the answer is no, the executive will retain full control. In theory, cohorts might do so by reducing the variance associated with these decisions, fewer big mistakes in either direction, but we will ignore this possibility, which is never adduced to support judicial intervention. Rather, the standard claim is that government errs systematically in a particular direction. Insufficient disclosure. We suggest that the critical question is a comparative institutional one. Will adding judicial involvement, itself partially determined by the decisions of litigating groups, create a net improvement in the government's overall response strategy? In general, two conditions must hold for this to be so. First, there must be some mechanism that causes the executive systematically to make suboptimal decisions about whether, when, and how to release information that might rebut conspiracy theories. If executive branch decisions are unbiased, in the sense that they are accurate on average, even if randomly mistaken in particular cases, then courts will be hard-pressed to improve upon them. Second, even if the executive branch does make predictable errors, the litigation process must have some relative institutional advantage. In this regard, it must be able to improve upon the executive's choices. The benchmark is not optimal disclosure, but the disclosure that actually results from adding litigation-based oversight to executive branch decisions. There is little reason to think, in general, that both of these conditions will usually be met. In the Flight 77 case, Judicial Watch offered no concrete reason why the executive would erroneously balance the relative benefits and costs of disclosing the information immediately, including, 1. The expected gain to the government's efforts to rebut the Flight 77 conspiracy theories, 2. The expected costs to national security of disclosing details about the Department of Defense's surveillance activities and methods, and, 3. The lost option value of disclosing later, rather than now. Judicial Watch noted that, 2. Was low, because most of the information was already public in one way or another, and this seems plausible. However, 1. Was also low. As we have detailed above, the video's release did little to squelch the Flight 77 conspiracy theorists, who promptly folded the video into their theories. Factor 3 is hard to estimate, but it is clear that when courts require disclosure in such situations, the value of the option to make a later disclosure is systematically destroyed. Even if the executive would make mistakes about these factors, viewed in the light of hindsight, it is plausible to think that those mistakes will tend to be randomly distributed, in part because governmental interests are on both sides of the balance. In any event, Judicial Watch offered no reason to think that the litigation process would systematically do better. In general, the argument for compelled disclosure is strongest when the executive branch is likely to be systematically biased against disclosure for self-serving reasons. This is the argument that most plausibly justifies freedom of information request itself. When a conspiracy theory is at work, there is unlikely to be any systematic bias against disclosure because the executive has a strong incentive to correct the theory. To be sure, the first of the two conditions we have mentioned, that executive branch disclosures are not optimally geared to suppressing conspiracy theories, does seem plausible under certain conditions. Because the executive is partially a they, not an it, it's, their efforts to respond to conspiracy theories may be hampered by poor coordination across agencies or executive departments. Perhaps, for example, one agency holds information that it refuses to disclose or even transmit within the executive branch, although another agency or another branch of government needs it to combat a conspiracy theory. Here there is a kind of intra-executive externality, with one agency failing to take into account the full costs of its actions to other institutions. Moreover, if there are systematic incentives for overclassification and excessive government secrecy, a claim that is often heard but rarely fleshed out with concrete mechanisms, then there will be systematic error in government responses, with too little disclosure or disclosure coming too late. However, these possibilities are balanced by equally speculative possibilities cutting in other directions. If the executive is a they, not an it, it may also be the case that a given agency does not fully take into account the harms of disclosure to the mission of other agencies, and the problem will be too much disclosure or premature disclosure from the standpoint of the latter agencies. Intra-executive externalities and agency incentives may cut in either direction. Their net effect is hard to assess in the abstract, and there is little reason to think they necessarily create a systematic skew in one direction or another. Furthermore, addressing conspiracy theories is not the only thing the executive does. Even if an agency is not acting optimally with respect to that goal, it may be acting in a way that promotes good policy, somehow defined, overall. Most importantly, there is little general reason to think that the second condition, that litigating groups and judges can improve upon the executive's choices, will often be met. First, if agencies may hold motivations or face incentives that distort the optimal approach to information disclosure, courts suffer from deficits of expertise and policy-making ability that hamper their efforts to make things better. Here a serious problem is that courts decide one case at a time. While this practice has many benefits, it makes it difficult for courts to gain a systemic view across an array of cases in order to decide whether an agency's decisions are systematically distorted, or to evaluate whether inter-executive externalities are occurring. Second, suppose that the court does know better than the executive how and when to disclose information in order to rebut a conspiracy theory. The problem is that the court may be legally constrained not to act optimally in any event. There is no necessary connection between the timing of the lawsuit and the optimal timing of disclosure for addressing the relevant conspiracy theory. In the Judicial Watch case, the optimal time of disclosure may have been never. Given the low benefits, it may also have been at some time in the future. The court, however, is legally constrained from acting on its open-ended assessment. It may decide that the plaintiff prevails and disclosure occurs, or not, but in general it may not fine-tune the timing of disclosure at will. In all of these remarks, we have made two assumptions that cabin the analysis. We are not offering a general account of Freedom of Information Act litigation. We have assumed first of all that, as in the Judicial Watch litigation the plaintiff's avowed purpose is to force a disclosure, that in the plaintiff's judgment will rebut a spreading conspiracy theory. In internal legal terms, this is irrelevant. The Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that reviewing courts should not consider the specific interests of the requester in obtaining Freedom of Information Act disclosure. However, it is certainly relevant from an external standpoint, where the question is how to assess the institutional capacities of relevant actors, where the aim of all concerned actors, including the plaintiffs, is to supply an optimal response to conspiracy theories rather than to assert other interests. There are special grounds for doubting that the litigation process can improve upon executive branch choices. We have also assumed that the relevant statutes are sufficiently ambiguous or vague that both agencies and courts are at least in part making policy choices, rather than enforcing the law in any simple sense. Where this is not so, and the commands of Freedom of Information Act are clear, courts should enforce them. If the resulting disclosure is not optimally timed, the problem lies with the statute, as applied. In general, however, this is not the situation such cases will pose. Rather, the agency resists disclosure under a vague or broadly worded Freedom of Information Act exemption, and perhaps also by invoking principles such as the mosaic theory, according to which government may resist disclosures that are innocuous in themselves, but that can be assembled into a larger picture damaging to national security. If the reviewing court does not face a clear legal command, and if the court lacks confidence, as we do, that the litigation process will on average produce better responses to conspiracy theorizing, then the court should stay its hand. A note on conspiracy theories abroad. Our focus has been on domestic conspiracy theories, although some of the relevant considerations are constant across both domestic and foreign audiences. Conspiracy theories flourish in many Middle Eastern and predominantly Muslim countries, so much so that there is a small literature asking why Muslims are so prone to conspiracy theorizing. One paper by Freudian psychologists even ascribes this fact to Muslim child-rearing practices. We are skeptical. If many Muslims abroad are prone to conspiracy theorizing, so too are many non-Muslims in the United States, as the evidence given above demonstrates. On the other hand, we have conjectured that there is a causal link between the prevalence of conspiracy theories and the relative absence of civil liberties and a well-functioning marketplace of ideas, so it is unsurprising that such theories are even more widespread in the Muslim world and in the United States. Overall, conspiracy theorizing is undoubtedly virulent in the Muslim world, has a sharply anti-American inflection, and poses problems that are somewhat distinctive, so a brief discussion is warranted. On the diagnostic side, it is highly likely that the virulence of conspiracy theorizing in Muslim nations has a great deal to do with social cascades and group polarization, and with weak civil liberties, and the lack of a robust market for ideas in many of those nations. In terms of our suggested policy responses, the foreign setting is both a worse and a better environment for the U.S. government. It is worse in that the nature of the relevant institutions and audiences in the Muslim world sharpens many of the dilemmas and trade-offs we have described. Typically, the audience is antecedently skeptical, in the extreme, of anything said by United States officials. Shortly we will see that this creates enormous pressure for the U.S. to engage in various forms of covert or anonymous speech. The marketplace of ideas in many Muslim nations is institutionally fragile or dominated by powerful governments. civil liberties, including free speech, are often shaky. The upside to the foreign setting, however, is that on some dimensions the U.S. enjoys greater freedom of action, in part because domestic U.S. politics will tolerate some actions abroad that it would not tolerate if taken at home. We begin with the difficulties. The foreign setting sharpens one of the central trade-offs we have identified to enhance the credibility of speech that debunks conspiracy theories. The government must surrender some degree of control over the institutions of speech. In 2004, the U.S. government set up a broadcast network for the Middle East, Al Hurra, the free one that puts out news and third-party opinion. In May 2007, a House subcommittee called a hearing to investigate reports that Al Hurra had broadcast terrorist content, including a 68-minute call to arms against Israelis, by a senior figure of the terrorist group Hezbollah, and deferential coverage of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's Holocaust denial conference. Legislators sharply questioned officials of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the government corporation that ultimately funds Al Hurra, and those officials had to promise to address the legislators' concerns. Those problems, however, were part and parcel of a broader strategy for enhancing credibility by permitting other viewpoints and voices on the air. In general, in order to enhance its credibility with antecedently skeptical Muslim audiences, the U.S. government must go a long way towards surrendering control over the content of its speech, or must speak anonymously, a strategy that carries its own risks, as we mention next. However, as this episode reveals, domestic political constraints may preclude whatever mix of credibility and control is optimal from the standpoint of dampening conspiracy theories or promoting U.S. public relations goals more generally. The alternative to surrendering control over the content of the government's responses, in order to enhance credibility, is for government officials or agents to speak anonymously. A mini-scandal erupted in 2006 when U.S. newspapers revealed that the Lincoln Group, an independent contractor of influence services, had paid Iraqi newspapers to publish hundreds of news stories written by U.S. military personnel, but not identified as such, most of which portrayed events in Iraq in cheery terms or rebutted circulating conspiracy theories. The stories were factually true, but selective. As against the obvious moral objections to this practice, the Lincoln Group argued that speech identified as stemming from U.S. sources would, even if true, credible and important, be utterly discounted by the Iraqi audience, leaving the field entirely to conspiratorial and hostile rumors. On this view, the implicit lie of planting news stories not identified to their true sources is necessary in a deliberative environment that is already warped to the goal of putting all relevant information before a quasi-rational audience, where the marketplace of ideas is already malfunctioning in the sense that relevant audiences discount to zero statements that should carry positive weight. Practices that would not be permissible in a well-developed liberal state might be permissible on second-best grounds. A better objection to this practice may instead be tactical. By outsourcing this form of quasi-propaganda to an independent contractor, whose participation would sooner or later be brought to light, the U.S. government fell between two stools, obtaining neither the credibility benefits of full transparency nor the credibility benefits of totally anonymous speech. Ruel Mark Garrett, a former CIA case officer, commented that the historical parallel would be the CIA's efforts during the Cold War to fund magazines, newspapers, and journalists who believed that the West should triumph over communism. Much of what you do ought to be covert, and, certainly, if you contract it out, it isn't. So far we have discussed the distinctive difficulties of the foreign setting. On other dimensions, however, the foreign setting loosens various legal and political constraints, allowing the U.S. government greater freedom in responding to conspiracy theories. In 2004, the U.S. Administrator for Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, ordered troops to shut down a weekly newspaper in Baghdad that had propounded false conspiracy theories damaging to the U.S., such as a story that an American missile, not a terrorist car bomb, had caused an explosion that killed more than 50 Iraqi police recruits. Whether this sort of action does more harm than good in similar environments is a complicated question, depending on difficult judgments about the etiology of conspiracy theories, the consequences of censorship, and the efficacy of U.S. counter-speech. On the one hand, there are the familiar arguments that censorship attracts attention to the censored speech or publication and fuels further conspiracy theorizing. Perhaps the inference might run, the U.S. is moving against a particular rumor because it is true, or is moving against a particular paper because it is exposing actual U.S. conspiracies. Furthermore, censorship might just drive the conspiracy theories underground to be spread and mutated by personal rumor-mongering that is less susceptible to focused rebuttal. On the other hand, the peculiar environment in which Bremer acted may weigh in favor of a policy of censoring publication of conspiracy theories. One editorial argued that the occupation authorities have plenty of means, including their own television station, to get out a more favorable message. However, this ignores the effect discussed above, that the antecedent skepticism of the Iraqi audience is so strong that any U.S. statements, even if true, credible and important, will be ignored altogether. With an audience already thoroughly in the grip of conspiracy theories, open counter-speech may simply be more grist for the conspiratorial mill. Consider that when Al-Hur began its operations, a conspiracy theory quickly circulated, claiming that the short-term contracts given to Al-Hur personnel showed that the station was set up only to bolster George W. Bush's re-election campaign, and would presumably be shut down after the election. Given the extremely low efficacy of U.S. counter-speech in this sort of environment, the realistic options may be limited to censorship and anonymous or quasi-anonymous counter-speech, in the style of the Lincoln Group. Whatever the merits of these pragmatic and tactical questions, the availability of censorship gives U.S. officials operating in foreign countries an extra instrument for coping with conspiracy theories, one that is not available in the domestic arena due to both legal and political constraints. Conclusion. Our goal here has been to understand the sources of conspiracy theories and to examine potential government responses. Most people lack direct or personal information about the explanations for terrible events, and they are often tempted to attribute such events to some nefarious actor. The temptation is least likely to be resisted if others are making the same attributions. Conspiracy cascades arise through the same processes that fuel many kinds of social errors. What makes such cascades most distinctive and relevantly different from other cascades involving beliefs that are both false and harmful is their self-insulating quality. The very statements and facts that might dissolve conspiracy cascades can be taken as further evidence on their behalf. These points make it especially difficult for outsiders, including governments, to debunk them. Some conspiracy theories create serious risks. They do not merely undermine democratic debate. In extreme cases, they create or fuel violence. If government can dispel such theories, it should do so. One problem is that its efforts might be counterproductive, because efforts to rebut conspiracy theories also legitimate them. We have suggested, however, that government can minimize this effect by rebutting more rather than fewer theories, by enlisting independent groups to supply rebuttals, and by cognitive infiltration designed to break up the crippled epistemology of conspiracy-minded groups and informationally isolated social networks.